The title of today's sermon is Job's Conversion. And I'd like you to put your marker in the book of Job. We're going to begin there in Job chapter 4, brethren. The book of Job is a very ancient book. Sometimes I'm surprised to find out how ancient it is, and I don't think the experts really understand how far it goes back. It's difficult to understand, and it's little used, even among God's people. The book of Job is about how God ultimately brought Job to conversion. And it's a true conversion, a Christian conversion. Job is a remarkable book. John, Peter, and Paul were all moved and inspired by Job, as was King David. And as you read through Job, you'll see where these men either copied directly or referred to the things that they learned in the book of Job. Job knew a great deal about our beliefs and understanding this early on. This is what is surprising when you go through the book of Job. Even when Paul wrote in Romans 8:28, all things work together for the good, that comes directly. That's the lesson that Job had to learn. And you just see it popping up all through the scriptures once you study the book of Job. Job is often quoted in the writings of John, Peter, Paul, David. And so we know that his works were before them when they were doing their writing. In fact, that's the way the inspiration of God works. A little here and a little there. You put it all together. Even the beloved apostle John, when he's writing at almost 100 A.D., he refers to the fact that Satan is the accuser of the brethren. How does he know that? Well, God gave it to him. God inspired him. But yet he saw it directly in the book of Job, where Satan is the one who is accusing Job. Ancient Job was an amazing man. That's an understatement to say that he was an amazing man. He was rich, and he was a very great man. Job was a priest who offered sacrifices. He was a ruler and a judge, a high judge. He was a brilliant scientist. He was an engineer, just like we have engineers today. He was a miner, digging the elements out of the earth. Of course, he had his crews because he was very rich and he owned more than one mine. He was a geologist. He was a meteorologist. He understood about the rain and the snow and the water vapor and the atmospheric pressures and things like the humidity and content of the air with moisture and things like that. He was an agriculturist. He was a mathematician. He was an architect. And he was an astronomer. He knew shortly after the flood when he lived that the earth was round. So it's nonsense to say there are people that don't know that the earth is round. Study out those different jobs that Job had as you study through the book of Job. You'll find it fascinating because he's such a well-educated man. You wonder, how did he get the education that he had that long ago? Job owned caravans. I don't know how many. It doesn't tell us. You can have a lot of caravans with 3,000 camels. He had ranches. He had farms. He was a manufacturer. He was a merchantman in the mercantile industry, and he was a faithful husband. All of these different hats that Job wore must have kept him extremely busy. Job was world-renowned. I don't know what kind of communications they had for long distances in those days. Maybe they carried the mail in the camel caravans even that far back. But Job was on top of the world. As we begin the book of Job, you know the story. God allowed Satan to take everything away from Job. Job didn't just come down a notch or two. He came all the way down to zero. Job lived in that time period between Noah's flood and the calling of Abraham. You remember how we had all the time from Adam and Eve up to the flood when God, because of the iniquity of man, wiped out everybody except Noah, 8 souls, Noah and his family. Well, Noah's 3 boys and their wives began to replenish the earth again. And it's not that many generations from Noah to the time of Abraham. That is the time when Job lived, when Job wrote. That was a very ancient time. You can say to yourself, how much mining and engineering and astronomy could be known by man in that time when everything on earth had been destroyed. I think we would be amazed to find out how much knowledge was carried over in the ark with Noah. I'm sure he brought books and instruments and a lot of things that we're not told about. It would be interesting, and it will be interesting, to find out sometime how much technology made it over the flood and into the new world. Job lived to be approximately 250 years old. 250 years old. We're not told exactly, but we can look at his life before his trials and after his trials, and we're given some numbers and we put them together, and that's approximation. You might say 240, 250, but somewhere in there. One of the things that I want to point out, brethren, is how the lifespan, the longevity of man changed drastically at the time of the flood. You know, I've spoken to you before that it appears that God created Adam and Eve to be able to live for 1,000 years. And if they hadn't taken of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Adam and Eve would have lived 1,000 years. They would have completed the course of man. They would have gone through the resurrection, been raised to eternal life, and it would have been the 1,000-year plan of God. But it didn't work out that way. And we see quite a few of the people that are recorded of living well over 900 years. And because of sin and iniquity and deprivation and all the things that come along with sin, they didn't make it all the way to 1,000. The Bible records no man living to be 1,000 years old. But some came very, very close. We think Methuselah came the closest. He is the closest that's recorded. I think 969 years. But the flood changed everything. We're told that Noah lived for 950 years. That's a good long lifetime. But then he had those three boys, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem lived 600 years. That's a drastic change from what your dad lives, 350 years shorter than your dad. But because the earth changed, the climate changed, so much changed with the flood. You remember the waters beneath the earth gushed forward and came forth, and the waters that were in the heavens came down. The climate changed, the atmosphere changed, the atmospheric pressure changed. There were a lot of things that were different after the flood. And so Shem lived about 600 years. So as we study through even what the Bible gives us, especially what the Bible gives us, after the flood, the lifespan of man rapidly began to decrease, and it decreased by about 90% from what we can tell, from nearly 1,000 years of a lifespan down to less than 100 years. Now, God has preserved the numbers for us, and that helps us to determine how far back Job lived. Had Job had a lifespan of some 960 years or something, we'd say, okay, he was pre-flood. But he doesn't. He has a lifespan of about 250 years. Nobody lives that long today. When did it change? It changed immediately after the flood. And so God has preserved the numbers for us, and that helps us to determine how far back Job lived. It was a strange time when Job lived, and this will surprise some of you, but it's revealed in the book of Job that there were even dinosaur-like creatures that had not yet completely died out after the flood. Now, there are no references that I can think of right off the bat between the time of Adam and the flood that refer to dinosaurs. We know from the fossil records that there were all kinds of dinosaurs that were on this earth. And we know that the flood drowned out all the animals that had the breath of life, and it didn't affect the fishes. The fishes were unaffected by the flood. They made it right through the flood. And so the fish can go back and be prehistoric, and that's not a problem. But could there have been reptilian-like animals? Could it be that these dinosaur-like creatures made it over through the flood and lived into the time of Job? The scripture seemed to indicate that they were there, because he refers to animals that we don't have on the earth today. Of Noah's three sons, Shem's very important. That's the righteous line that came down through Noah on down to Abraham, that came down through Shem. That's where we get the word Semitic or Semite. Shem was the father of all the sons of Eber. That's where the Hebrews came from. You can put down Genesis 10 and verse 21 in your notes. Each generation, each subsequent generation after the flood had a shorter and shorter lifespan. Now, you can look at those and they just jump off the page. Just read Genesis chapter 11. It'll say somebody had a son when he was such and such an age and then he lived so many more years. You add them together and you see how long he lived. You can read Genesis 11 and make your own chart. Seven generations later, we come to a man whose name is Serug, S-E-R-U-G. Serug lived to be 230 years old. He was the great-grandfather of Abraham. And so we are wont to place Job in that proximity, somewhere in the neighborhood of Serug. Abraham lived to be 175. God made nations and a great nation out of Abraham. That's when God really began to work, and we can see the hand of God, and he promises Abraham a city and a promised land and so forth. We come down from Abraham through his children, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jacob had Joseph. Joseph lived to be 110 years old, and of course, when we get to the generation of David, we find men living 70 years, which is the span that God gives us today. So there's a graph. You can draw it out. And you can put Job right there around Serug about the time of Abraham's great-grandfather. So that gives us a rough idea of when it's written. Unfortunately, today, when we study Job, a lot of things have changed. And so we have to try to tweak our minds and say, okay, what is happening here? What is God revealing? What is he showing us? And we learn some very, very good lessons. Now, I grew up hearing that Job was a self-righteous man. Unfortunately, today, we most commonly hear Job being referred to as self-righteous Job. Let me explain the difference, brethren, between self-righteous and righteous. A self-righteous person is hiding a lot, but he tries to come across as being sanctimonious. We have a lot of phrases that we use. We'll say that he's holier than thou. That's a self-righteous person. You can almost picture them holding their nose high and looking down on everybody else. And you can hear it in their tone of voice. They're self-satisfied, smug, pious. Sometimes they can be preachy. Let me tell you how it is, in a put-down kind of way. They come across as being superior. In general, they are what some people would call goody-goodies because, in fact, they really have a lot to work on, but they want to appear righteous and they make themselves self-righteous. Too many people come across as possessing an attitude of moral superiority derived from a sense that their beliefs, their actions, their conduct are of a higher ethical caliber than those of the average person. They want to set themselves apart. It's common in the ministry. You see it in a lot of Protestants. Well, you see it in God's church as well. People that want to have airs about them of being above everybody else, not having time for other people, not wanting to waste their time on the peasants that are out there in the congregation. That is totally an ungodly conduct. Jesus Christ didn't act that way. Jesus Christ, though he was in actuality the highest, the supreme God, he rubbed shoulders with the people. He cared for the people. He hurt for the people. He had compassion and love, sincere love for the people. There's a difference between righteous and self-righteous. I just wanted to make a few comments about that because there are denominations that are known for their self-righteous disposition. And brethren, anybody that does that does God a disservice with their better-than-thou attitude. But let me ask you the question. Was Job like that? No, he wasn't. Over and over in the scriptures, we see that Job was not that kind of a self-righteous person. Job had three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. You'll run across them a whole lot in the book of Job. They certainly believed that Job had some secret faults that he was concealing. They thought he was being self-righteous. They thought that he wasn't leveling with them. And they didn't mind telling him so. They were wrong. You remember the old saying, with friends like that, who needs enemies? That describes Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Let's go over to Job chapter 4, brethren, because I want to give you some examples of these people that were counseling Job, trying to help him. And I want to point out that Eliphaz, he's the Temanite, he was not receiving his inspiration from God. When you are studying through the book of Job, remember that when you read these men's accusations, their inspiration was not coming from God. And I just want to show you an example of that. Eliphaz says in Job 4 and verse 12, "Now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a little thereof." That's not the way the scriptures are usually written. They're more succinct and to the point. But Eliphaz says in verse 13, "In thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on man," verse 14, "fear came upon me, and trembling, which made my bones shake." This is not normal sleep. This is not a normal dream that Eliphaz is sharing with us right here. But he doesn't realize that this is a self-accusation in telling us where this vision and where his inspiration is coming from. He says in verse 15, "Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up." You ever seen that, when the hair on the back of somebody's neck stands up for fright? That's what Eliphaz was going through. And then he speaks of the spirit in verse 16. "It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof." That's not the way God works, brethren. When Jesus Christ appeared, when angels appeared, it was never like this. This is something that's ungodly. "I could not discern the form thereof. It was a shapeless image before my eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying." Okay, I just wanted to take that little piece out so that when you're reading, understand that not all of these words are coming from God. We'll see in just a moment that Satan has gone to God and wants to taunt Job. He wants to accuse Job. He wants to destroy Job. I want you to understand about these quote-unquote friends that Job has. When you read what these three friends have to say, consider the source, because what you read after verse 16 right here is actually a quote from a demon spirit putting down on the way God interacts with his creation. He's putting down on Job in particular. Now, you'll find a lot of things that are true that come from these friends. That's the way Satan works. He'll give you 95% truth and then poison you with the other 5%. They say a lot of seemingly true things, but then the conclusions that they draw are not godly at all. Turn over to Job 8. Let's look at some more of this. We'll look at Bildad while we're talking about these three friends. Job's friend Bildad is just as bad, saying, "Job, you should repent." Job 8 and verse 1. "Then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said, how long will you speak these things? And how long shall the words of your mouth be like a strong wind?" Okay, he's talking ugly right there. What he's saying is, "Job, you're a bag of wind. You're just a lot of hot air." Drop down to verse 6. Notice the tone of voice here. This comes from Bildad the Shuhite. Verse 6. "If you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous." This is after the time Job has lost everything, and he's saying, if you were pure and upright, if you were blameless and upright, God would surely prosper you like before. He was one of the richest men in the world, if not the richest man in the world. Job, however, could not fathom why God would remove his blessings in a single stroke against him. Job was doing so good, world-renowned. So Job's friends surmised that he must have done something seriously sinful and wrong to deserve this punishment, this is the way they saw it, not a trial from God, that Job was receiving. And yet Job continuously maintained that he was doing everything that God required of him. What was the answer to Job's dilemma? Why did God allow Job to suffer a trial so horribly painful that he regretted the day that he was born? He really got down and was despairing. He was about to lose it all. Why did blameless Job have to suffer? That's one of the big questions. I think the world looks at the book of Job and they ask the question. They say, here's what the book of Job is about. Why do the innocent have to suffer? And they think that's the whole theme of Job. It goes much deeper and much farther than that. Job knew that far back, right after the flood, he knew in practice what Jesus Christ taught in the New Testament. Even though he lived well before Moses codified the law at Mount Sinai. But Satan and the demons constantly accused Job of wrongdoing, for which Job defended himself. In fact, as Job is pushed and shoved, we read over in Job 13 and verse 15, he's saying, you know, God has taken everything away. I've had all these boils and illness. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. But I will maintain my own ways before him. Job is saying, I did it right. I didn't do anything wrong. I did what God asked me to do. I did it to the best of my ability. I did it as perfectly as a man can do it. And I'm going to maintain that position. I'm not going to back off of that and say, yes, you know, I was stealing, lying, cheating, thieving, whatever. He didn't have a secret sin. Even God says he didn't have a secret sin. Job's opinion was that he was doing absolutely everything that was required as a righteous, godly man. Job trusted that his own personal, his self-evaluations, his evaluations of himself were always spot on, exactly right. He could see in his own mind's eyes, I am right in what I am doing. And brethren, for the most part, what he was doing was right on. And according to God, he was right on. We'll see that. But Job was not yet converted. That's part of what we'll see. That's why I've chosen the title, Job's Conversion, because that's what's going on in this book. And we thank God that he has given us this book, because it's got so many lessons in it and so many things that he's able to teach us from the book of Job. Job greatly underestimated the benevolence, the goodness, the purity, the perfection of God, and how superior God was to him. He came short in that. And I think, you know, you and I sitting here with all the books of the Bible and all the teachings and all the writings and explanations, we know a whole lot more of what's going on. I don't know what Job had by way of scripture, if any, in front of him. Now, the record of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's written for us, and it seems to precede the book of Job, but Abraham doesn't live, as we saw, for a number of generations. So most of that wasn't written. The only thing that could have been passed down from a flood is what happened in that time from the flood. And if we read what happened between Adam and Eve up to the flood, there's a whole lot of what we've learned in our Christian lives that's missing. It's not there. So I think we have to give Job a little room. In fact, I am astounded at the depth of his spiritual knowledge, understanding what he knew of God, that comes out as we read the book of Job. So Job was blameless, but he didn't start to realize how awesome God is and that God is always just and fair and right. He hadn't come to that concept. He didn't understand that yet. Job had a lot to learn, and God was working in Job's life to bring him to the highest notch. I talked about how God knocked him down to the lowest notch, to where he had nothing. That was not God's intent to keep him there. God had to get his attention. God had to be able to work with him. And that's the way that God, in his perfect wisdom, knew to do it. And it worked. And so God was right, as always. And we should never, ever doubt that. That was part of Job's problem, doubting that God was doing things in the best way, in the equitable way, in the righteous way. But if you had lived at the time of Job, and you met him, and you saw how he worked with people, and how he worked with his business, and how he worked serving God, you would have come to the truth that Job was the epitome of human righteousness. He was doing everything right, as much as a man can do everything right. Let's go back now to Job chapter 1, and we'll read here a little bit and get a picture of what was going on in the beginning. Job 1 and verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and avoided evil. He eschewed evil. Okay, right there, brethren, in that very first verse, we can see that he wasn't self-righteous because God himself says that he was perfect and upright and one that feared God and avoided evil. Now, let me make a clarification here because this has been brought up to me. He was not perfect and sinless as only Jesus Christ is. Jesus Christ is the only man who has ever lived who was perfect that way, leading a spotless, sinless, perfect life. A better translation of that word perfect, when you come to Job 1:1, a better translation would be that he was blameless and upright. And I'll explain that. As all men do, Job would slip up and sin. I don't know what Job did. Maybe a camel stepped on his toe and he said something ugly. Or maybe he got impatient and raised his voice. But I want you to understand this. When he got his toe stepped on, he immediately caught himself and said, okay, that's not proper of a man of God, and he curbed his tongue. Or when he felt himself getting impatient, he reined himself in. That's a word you'll see in the book of Job a number of times. He brought himself under control. I'll mention that a time or two because he used the word rein, like you steer a horse right and left with the reins. You rein it, you pull back on him, you rein him in. That's the way you make him stop. That's synonymous with control. And he had self-control, and Job had a lot of self-control. So, yes, he would slip up and sin, but he did not live a life of sinfulness. He didn't just say, okay, you know, I'm skimming off the top and I'm going to do that the rest of my life. That's the way you get a hit. He didn't have a continuous sin in his life. He was blameless and he was upright. He walked in God's way to the extent that in the book of Ezekiel, God goes beyond saying that Job is blameless and upright. And God himself, through Ezekiel, calls Job righteous. You can put this in your notes and go look at that, because we can't go off on every tangent, but I just want you to have that even God calls Job righteous in Ezekiel chapter 14 and verse 14, in Ezekiel 20. He's one of the few people that's referred to in that way in the scriptures. Okay, we come to verse 2, Job 1 and verse 2. And there was born unto Job 7 sons and 3 daughters. So you picture that. When God gives us that, say, wow, 10 of them, nice big family. And Job was an extremely rich man, more so than Donald Trump by far today. Donald Trump is not one of the richest men in America by far. There are some really, really rich people. Or Bill Gates. He was rich like Bill Gates is today. Let's look at what he had. Job 1 and verse 3. For his substance was 7,000 sheep. Picture that, brother. How many hills does it take to graze 7,000 sheep on? So he's got a lot of land and a lot of sheep. He has 3,000 camels. Now let me call your attention to 3,000 camels. If you lined up 3,000 camels in the inn, that would make quite a caravan. But that's not how long the caravan was. He had breeding camels, he had young camels, he had old camels. I don't know the camel business, but if you have 3,000 camels, you know the camel business. But I want to point out and emphasize the 3,000 because you know that he's going to lose it all. They're going to be stolen and rustled. You rustle cattle and you rustle camels, I imagine. That's how he lost the camels. The bad guys came in and rustled the camels away. At the end of the book, we'll find that after he lost his 3,000 camels, he ends up with 6,000 camels. So the end of Job is very, very good. He had 500 female donkeys and a very great household. That's a lot of servants. Now, when it says a great household, we're talking about people that were doing the mining, going on the caravans, going in all of his businesses, doing all the work, so that this man was the greatest of all men in the East. So we're told how great he was. We come to verse 4. And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. He had to send for the sisters because they're married to other men and they come from their household, so they're having this big, big feast. Job was not of the immediate line. As we read the people that we see from Noah going down through Shem all the way down to Abraham, we don't find Job's name there. So he's not in that righteous line. But yet we know that he descended from Noah, and by all means through Shem. We don't know how far off that righteous line he was. He could have been a brother, a brother-in-law, or something like that. But he knew how to sacrifice. You remember how Noah offered sacrifices right after the ark landed? That made it through the flood. We see sacrifices with Adam and Eve and with Abel and Cain. They brought sacrifices. That was what God taught them to do. That was part of their offerings to God. We see that that's replicated in Job's life. He knew he was a priest. He was the one that was able to sacrifice and to give offerings to God. Verse 5. And so it was, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sacrificed them, and rose up early in the morning, and he offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. So he was offering sacrifices for sin for his children because he wanted them to be right with God, and he was doing everything he knew to help them, as he saw it, be righteous as well. It's always difficult to raise kids, and he's worried about the kids and what they might be doing. Job 1 and verse 6. Now, there was a day when the sons of God, now when you say sons of God, we're talking about good and bad angels. They must give an accounting to God, so they're accounting to God. God knows what's going on, and everybody has to give accounting. The sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. So we find out a great deal right here that Satan, even though he's left his former estate, he too has to give an accounting to God. And he can't just go off freelance and do what he wants. God has, to this day, very strong reins on Satan. And there are times when God has loosened the reins, and there are times when God tightens the reins on Satan. Satan is not a free agent to do what he wants. And God has not seen fit to destroy Satan yet, because God uses Satan in his overall plan. That's a whole another big subject. Verse 7. And the Lord said unto Satan, "Where you come from, where you been?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro in the earth, from walking up and down in it." Yeah, that's where he works. That's where he makes trouble. That's his domain on the earth. That's where he's supposed to be. And he's kind of saying, like, where else would I be? That's where you've stuck me. I can't go anywhere but there. Of course, he's down there causing trouble and mayhem everywhere that he can. Verse 8, and the Lord said unto Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil?" Well, certainly, Satan knows about Job. You know, richest guy in the world, greatest man in the East and so forth. He knows he'd like to have a piece of Job. He'd like to destroy Job. But Satan says, "Yeah, I know him, but he's off limits to me because you bless him every which way that he turns. He can do no wrong in your sight." So that's the way Satan answers God. He says, "Sure, I know who he is, but what can I do about it?" And so in verse 9, we see the actual words that are in the scriptures. Satan answered the Lord and says, "Doth Job fear God for nothing, for naught?" What he's saying is that Job has a cushy position. He's protected, he's looked out for, he's blessed, and I can't get to him. Now, brother, you remember how Jesus once told Peter that Satan desires you, Peter? You can read about that in Luke 22 and verse 31. The Lord said, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you." Well, that goes along with everybody else, and that's what we see right here. Satan really desired the destruction of Job in the exact same way. Satan says to God, "But I can't even get near to Job. You got protection, a wall of protection around him." We read that in verse 10. This is Satan saying this to God. "Have you not made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands." That should be emphasized. "Tremendously blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land." Yes, he's filthy rich is what Satan is saying. And Satan is intimating that it would be an entirely different story if Job wasn't constantly protected by you and blessed by you, God. If you removed your hand from him, I tell you what, Job would drop you like a hot pancake. He's doing this because, you know, that's where the money is. That's where the blessings are. Verse 11. But Satan says, "Do this, God. Put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. And you know what will happen? He'll curse you to your face. He'll turn on you so quick it'll make your head spin." So that's the conversation that's going on. So God calls Satan on it. Verse 12. And the Lord said unto Satan, "Behold, all that Job has is in your power. Only upon himself put not forth your hand." So, God is saying, you can touch Job, his mines, his camel, his sheep, whatever you want, and you see if he turns around and curses me. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. So God said to him, look, keep your hands off of Job, but you can touch anything that he has. And so Satan proceeds to take all of Job's property and his children and his houses and his businesses and his contacts and everything. Now, brethren, you need to understand this. Satan tempts so that we will fail. God tests us so that we will succeed. Now, that hadn't quite settled on Job yet. He didn't understand that way. So what happens is as soon as God gave Satan the leeway to take the things that Job has, Satan went to work. Disaster after disaster strikes Job. Verse 13, "There was a day when the sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and there came a messenger unto Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them." This is just a regular day in business. Everything's going along fine. But then notice what happens in verse 15. These neighbors, these foreigners, "The Sabaeans fell upon them and they took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I am escaped alone to tell you." They leave one person alive to go back and, you know, report, "Here's what happened. It's all gone. We've taken everything." Verse 16. "And while that servant was still giving an account of how the edge of the sword had come on them, the servants and so forth, before he even finished his report, verse 16 says, "There came also another and said, the fire of God has fallen from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell you." So again, one person comes back with the evil report. "And while he was yet speaking," verse 17, "there came also another and said, the Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the camels, and they carried them away, and they have slain your servants with the edge of the sword, and I, only I am escaped alone to tell you these things." So this terrible news is coming on Job all within 2 minutes. Verse 18, "And while he was yet speaking, it came another one and said, your sons and your daughters Now this is getting close to home. They were eating and they were drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. Things couldn't be better. We're rich. You know, I think about Walton when I read that thing about Job being the richest man that there was. I Googled who are the richest people today, and there's a whole bunch of people that I'd never heard of. But the Waltons, there's a couple of the Waltons who are the richest people in the world, and they're the children of Sam Walton. Even when he died and split up his inheritance, they were filthy rich. They're some of the richest people in America. So that's who's eating and drinking here, these very wealthy sons and daughters of Job. They're eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. It must have been a castle of a mansion. And behold, verse 19, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men and their dead, and I am escaped to tell you. So disastrous. He's lost his family. He's lost all of his business holdings. He's lost everything. Verse 20. Job arose. He rent his mantle. You can imagine the anguish and the hurt of losing his family first and then everything else. He shaved his head. Notice what he did. He fell down on the ground and he worshiped. And brethren, which of us, when we have sore trials, the first thing that we do is get on our knees and worship God? But that's what he did. Notice, I want you to notice very closely. Job did not curse God as Satan said that he would. Remember, Satan said, you touch him like that and he'll curse you to your face. Job didn't. That's how righteous Job was. Verse 21. Look at his attitude. He said, verse 21, Job said, naked as a little baby, I came out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord's taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He's got a fantastic attitude, even in the face of these sore trials. Verse 22, notice, these are the words of God. In all of this, Job sinned not, nor charge God foolishly. He's got a good record going here, the way that Job's dealing with all of this. And though he examined himself very, very closely, and here, brethren, I want to start pointing out where Job came short. Job is not perfect, as I said, like Jesus Christ is perfect. Job is not perfect. Job has something that God is going to work on with Job to bring him to perfection, the absolute perfection that all the sons and daughters of God will have in the kingdom of God. Notice, Job did not have an I need you, God, attitude. He was a self-made man. He thought that he had done all of these things himself. And the fact that when Job thought about all that he possessed, all that he had, the workings, the business that he had, he thought, I did that myself. God didn't bless me with it. He wasn't giving God the credit. That attitude that Job had made his conversion one of the most difficult that we find in the scriptures. When somebody thinks, I'm doing it all right, I did it all myself, that's hard to get into a mind like that. So that's what God is doing. God is getting into the mind and the heart and the soul of Job the way only God can do it. So in the book of Job, we see a righteous man seriously reflecting on his sore trial. He is asking himself, why? What did I do? I did it perfect. Why is this happening to me? He's trying to reconcile his miserable circumstances with what he feels to be his exemplary lifestyle. Did it all right. That's what he thought. So sin in Job's life, at least in the beginning of this discourse, is not the issue in the book of Job, nor is sin the reason for Job's trials. But God knew his heart. He knew his mind. God knew that Job was not at the top notch. He needed to go higher, but first he had to go much lower. Job knew so much of God's plan in the resurrection of the righteous that I'm surprised. It comes out in the book. When you read it, you see that Job knew about the resurrection to life, to eternal life, to spirit life. He knew those things. The knowledge of God had come down to him through Noah. We're not told that God appeared to Job and inspired him and gave him these things. So it had come down from man to man, from Noah to Shem and on down. And these men must have really studied it. They were keeping the feast. We see that Abel was keeping the feast. Adam and Eve had been given the feast. They were learning a lot, and God may have opened their minds at feast time and on the holy days to show them a lot of these great things. And those things, if Job did understand those things to that depth, they were subsequently lost, at least not recorded in the scriptures, like we have been blessed. Brethren, we have been so blessed to have the plan of God shown to us as they're portrayed by the holy days and spelled out. That's a great gift that God has given us. So the knowledge of God had to have come down through Noah, who was also a righteous man, blameless in his generations, and he too walked with God. That knowledge traversed the flood from before the flood, when the whole world was iniquity. It traversed the flood and down to Shem and on down to Job. That's the way that it took place. The book of Job shows us just how much godly knowledge was retained by that righteous line, because the righteous line contained all of that material. And then those who went up to the feast in the holy days with them and worked with them and were families with them, they were privy to that information as well. And it came on down to Abraham. Abraham was looking for a city, and God worked directly with Abraham. That's another story. Let's go over to Job chapter 2. I want to pick it up here in verse 3. God said, "There's none like him in the earth," talking about Job, "a perfect and upright man." We're reading in Job 2 in verse 3. "One that fears God and eschews," he turns away from evil, "and still he holds fast to his integrity." That's the surprising thing right there, brethren. We see that Job is holding fast to his integrity, although Satan, moved me against him to destroy him without cause. So God's taking up from Job, said, look at him. He's holding fast to his integrity. He's not crumbling. He didn't do anything wrong. He's not stealing, lying, cheating, whatever. He's keeping the Sabbath. He's sacrificing, praying, tithing. He's doing everything that he's supposed to. So what then is the book of Job all about? What lessons are we to learn? The book of Job has an incredibly spiritually and historically past. It is so revealing as we look into the book. Now, brethren, I understand it's a little hard. Might be even more than a little hard. That might be an understatement. It's hard to read. It's hard to understand because it's an ancient manuscript. But it is well worth studying it out. There's so much to learn here. If you're having problems, use different Bibles, different translations for better clarification. Read the studies that have been made on it. Ask questions and, you know, dig into it. Through his own force of will, Job had determined that he would be a man of blameless integrity and virtue, obtaining the highest of moral values. I'm not going to do anything wrong. I'm not going to look at what shouldn't be looked at. I'm not going to touch what shouldn't be touched. I'm not going to take what shouldn't be taken. He had a long list, and he lived by it. He reined himself in. He had a great deal of moral character, manly character, fierce, godly character. That's the way he lived. But God allowed Satan to turn the heat up on Job because we haven't gotten to the core of what Job doesn't understand. Verse 7, Job 2 and verse 7. "So went Satan forth from the presence of God." This is the second time. "And he smote Job," because this time God says, you can do everything except take his life. You can really touch his skin, but don't, whatever you do, don't take his life, because God is saving Job. He's still using Job. "And so Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord, and he smote Job with boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown." Brethren, this day in town, I've met people that have never had a boil or seen a boil. Boils are horrendous. I've seen them bigger than 50-cent pieces, the size of the red part is the size of a tennis ball with deep cores in a cavern that makes them look like a volcano. And when they explode, it's almost like a volcano. They are terrible things. He had them on the bottom of his feet and on the crown of his head. Verse 8, "And he took him a potsherd," that's a broken piece of glass, "to scrape himself withal. and he sat down among the ashes. So he hurts so bad, he's sitting on ashes. That's the softest thing he can find to sit on. They're rather antiseptic. There's no bugs or anything in the ashes. They've been sterilized that way. That's where he's sitting. And Job didn't even have the comfort of his wife. She should have been saying, "Poor Job, what can I do to make life easier for you?" Notice verse 9. Then said his wife unto him, "Do you still retain your integrity?" Even his wife wasn't on his side. "Curse God and die." How would you like to have a wife like that? Curse God and die. That's terrible. So Job, in addition to losing all his business and family and everything that he had, and then all of these sores from head to foot, he's got the mental anguish to deal with. He must have been terribly depressed, despondent. He must have been just totally out of it, down in the dumps. Verse 10, notice this. Would this be your attitude, brethren? Everything's gone. Your wife is saying, "Curse God and die." But he goes ahead and enters into conversation with her, and he said unto her, verse 10, "You speak as one of the foolish women speak. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God? Look at how you've lived, woman. You've had the best of everything, the best clothes, best jewelry, best food, best servants, the best of everything. Shall we receive good at the hand of God? And shall we not receive evil? In all of this, did not Job sin with his lips?" He didn't say an ugly thing, a mean thing, a cruel thing. He did not curse God. Job is chastened also with pain upon his bed, and it went all the way to the bone. We read in Job 33 and 19, just put this one down, brother. You don't have to turn back there. Job 33, 19. "And the multitude of his bones, they were chastened with strong pain." He hurt to the core of his being. If you ever had a back pain, if you ever had a broken knee, he hurt bad. The sore trial of Job was not because of a deliberate and habitual sin in Job's life. God tells us that's not what he's being corrected for. But he was chastised of God because God knew that he lacked a quality of spiritual understanding and substance that God wanted Job to have. Now, I mentioned how John, Peter, Paul, David were all inspired by Job. I wanted to give you one. Put this one in your notes, brethren. I believe, my own personal opinion, is that a lot of the things that Paul wrote, he gained the intuition, the understanding, and the inspiration from reading this story of Job. And he probably read it in the original Hebrew better than we can ever hope to understand it. But Paul shares with us what he took from Job. In Hebrews 12, verses 6 and 7, this is one of the lessons that Paul learned from Job's ordeal. Hebrews 12, 6 and 7. "For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and he severely disciplines every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as his own children." So that's what Paul took away from. That's one of the many things that he took away. James did the same thing. I didn't mention James, but James wrote in chapter 1 and verse 12, "Blessed is the man who endures these trials, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life." That's what it's all about for Job, receiving the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. James 1 and verse 13. "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone." So God is not trying to trip Job up, cause him to fail. That's what Satan does. Wants him to be destroyed. God is doing it so that Job can be saved. Brethren, that's our final goal. The reason for the trials. So that ultimately we can become holy as God is holy. That we might gain salvation. Let's turn over to Job chapter 31. There were an abundance of Christian principles that Job understood so well, so early on. That's what surprises me. Even before Moses talked to God, received the Ten Commandments and so forth. But Job, he had got to thinking that he did it all himself. I'm a self-man made. I made my opportunities. I planned, I sacrificed, I worked hard, I produced, I slaved, I saved, I worked hard for every penny I ever had. I did everything right. We know that as a priest, he offered acceptable sacrifices to God. God accepted his sacrifices. He cared for the poor. He cared for the maimed. He cared for the fatherless. He didn't let anybody go thirsty. It's very, very clear in the book of Job how generous and giving and caring he was. He was very generous, but he did not trust in his riches. He didn't trust in his wealth. Notice what Job said in Job 31 in verse 24 and 25. I don't know how a rich man could keep from trusting in his wealth. I've got my securities. I've got my annuities. I've got all this. I don't need you, God. I've got money to fall back on. I've got my plans to fall back on. But Job said in Job 31, beginning in verse 24, I have not made gold my hope. I'm not relying on gold or treasure. Or have said to the fine gold, you're my confidence. I got faith in you, in this gold. And no matter what happens, I can take this gold and start over or whatever. He said, I didn't say that. I did not rejoice because my wealth was great, but because my hand, I didn't rejoice because my hand had gotten me a great wealth and a great deal. But brethren, Job continuously attempted to justify himself. Now what follows is how God worked with Job to bring him to the point where he finally humbled himself and learned that he must be judged and God justified. Not judging God, the other way around. I want you to look at this, and this is a good place to close right here in Job 32 and verse 2. I might touch on a little bit more, but let's close with Job 32 and verse 32. This is the end of the story, and we find it right here. And if you mark anything at all, mark Job 32 and verse 32. Now, Elihu, we hadn't talked about Elihu too much. He's a real, real good guy. He's a manly, a God of man, a man of God, and a servant of God. He's like a young minister. He's a good guy. Don't get him mixed up with those first three that we talked about. Become conversant with those three bad friends that gave him so much trouble. Elihu is on the right path. I was at Pasadena. I heard a minister at Pasadena say Elihu was the worst of them all. I don't know what he didn't understand, but he didn't understand the book of Job. Now, maybe he read some of these verses and saw that Elihu got angry, and he said, you don't get angry, and so he's bad. Brethren, there is righteous indignation. There is a time to be angry. There is a time for Jesus Christ to overturn the tables that are in the temple. There's a time to say, you have made my father's house a den of thieves. Well, that's the way Elihu is right here in Job 32 and verse 30. Job 32 and verse 2. Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled. Why? Because Job justified himself rather than justifying God. There, that's the key to the whole thing. Job should have been saying, God is right. God is pure. God is holy. Everything God touches is right. God knows what he's doing. He's loving. He's saving him. He's saving us. He wants us to be made into his image, completely having his character, with his glory even. He's converting us into his glory. But Job wasn't doing that. He stood toe-to-toe with God and says, you've got no right doing this to me, because I did everything right. Job justified himself rather than justifying God. So that's it in a nutshell, brethren. That's where I'm going to stop today. Next time we'll take up on part two of Job's conversion. It's an interesting story. You might want to read the book of Job over the course of the week. And we'll touch on a whole lot more this coming Sabbath, God willing. We'll just go ahead and complete this story. I knew when I was finishing up my message, I went, there's way too much here to give in one message. So we'll do it in part two when we come back.